We speak of being inclined to do something. I'm inclined to think, and using the nominal rather than adjectival form of having an inclination to do that thing, I followed my inclination. But what we might mean in speaking of our actions thus is open to question. To have an inclination for something, to have, as we also say with a word that translates the Latin inclinatio, a leaning for it, can certainly mean simply to have a liking for that thing. But in another stronger sense, it can signify, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, a tendency or bent of the mind, of will or desires, a disposition or propensity to think and behave in certain ways. The OED defines inclination as a tendency, but it also uses inclination to define its first sense of tendency. A tendency is a leaning, inclination, bias or bent towards some object, effect or result. Ordinary linguistic intuitions then, at least as recorded in the dictionary, seem to present the terms tendency and inclination as equally fundamental and by implication as equally unanalyzable. Certainly, there are differences between the two terms. We might consider that inclination carries an idea of liking and desire, which tendency does not. And we may also think that tendency names both a statistical regularity and the force or power that produces that statistical regularity, whereas this double meaning is less evident in the idea of inclination. Inclination can be contrasted with tendency then, but both terms raise significant, even fundamental issues in, first of all, the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of action. Does an inclination operate by providing, in some sense, reasons for the will? If not, does an inclination operate as a kind of cause that makes the action no longer voluntary, and thus no longer, strictly speaking, an action at all? Or is it not rather the case that the will itself is inclined? And this in such a way that inclination would be irreducible either to reasons or to mechanical causation, to causation understood as necessitation. In what follows, I address these questions by means of the work of Félix Ravisson, who I imagine will not be familiar to all of you, but who nevertheless has a strong claim to the title of France's most influential philosopher in the second half of the 19th century. He was a pivotal thinker in the French spiritualist tradition that leads from Pierre Mendébuyan at the beginning of the century to Henri Bergson's global celebrity at the century's end. Ravisson wrote three major works, a two-volume study of Aristotle's metaphysics, which shows you the background against which he's thinking about inclination. A two-volume study of Aristotle's metaphysics published in 1837 and 1846, a brief but brilliant doctoral dissertation on habit entitled De l'habitude in 1838, and a report on the history of French philosophy in 1867, which served as a manifesto for his own spiritualist philosophy. It's in Of Habit that Ravisson presents in the most direct fashion a metaphysics of tendency or inclination, and that is to say an account of powers is as intrinsically tendential. The power or force of habit, he argues, which is coextensive with life, is a function not of some kind of mechanical necessity, but rather of inclination or tendency. The purpose of this paper is to explore this thesis and to use it to evaluate contemporary attempts to account for the nature of tendencies. For the issue of tendency has gained importance in recent theories of causation and in the contemporary metaphysics of powers, drawing inspiration from the ideas of J.S. Mill, Daniel von Wachter, Stephen Mumford and Raleigh Lil-Anjum, have all recently offered a tendency theory of causation, to cite the title of von Wachter's 2003 paper. Causes incline or tend towards their effects without necessitating them, and this tendency is a specific modal value, irreducible to traditional ideas of necessity or possibility. In their 2011 Getting Causes from Powers, Mumford and Anjum offer such a tendency theory of causation as a metaphysics of powers. Powers ground causal relations, but powers only incline or tend towards their effects, rather than necessitating them. Mumford and Anjum also argue, and this is particularly significant for the purposes of this paper, that we have a direct experience of, direct epistemological access to, tendencies in agency, and that this experience can be used to justify and ground a more general metaphysics of tendency in the world beyond our own agency. Ravisson may not be wholly unfamiliar to some of you, for in 2014 I presented a paper to Anna's Power Structuralism seminar entitled Inclination and the Modality of Dispositions. And it was on Mumford and Angham's claims concerning the modality of dispositions against the background of both Pierre Mendès-Biron's and Ravisson's ideas. This is a follow-up paper, and although it covers some of the same ground, I aim to address more directly and more broadly the question of tendency or inclination as a psychological and more general metaphysical issue. My argument, expressed negatively, is that it is not possible to account for the nature of tendency or inclination solely in terms of prevention and interference. If tendencies are characterised solely in this way, there is no need to concern oneself with the idea of tendency at all. In arguing that we should indeed concern ourselves with tendency, but in a stronger sense of the term, I hope also to be able to offer a perspective, in the end a Ravisonian perspective, on the nature of powers. If all powers are indeed tendencies, then a proper understanding of tendencies will produce a proper understanding of powers. On this point, even though I hope to have made some advances since 2014, my remarks are still in a sense exploratory. I'm currently finishing a book entitled Being Inclined, The Philosophy of Félix Ravisson, a book which aims to be at one and the same time a history book and a contribution to the metaphysics of powers. And I seem to have left the most difficult questions and the most fundamental issues to last. So more than usual, I'd be very grateful for your comments, suggestions and corrections. In the first section of the paper, I present Ravisson's conception of inclination and tendency in habit against the background of the ideas of Thomas Reid. In the second section, I try to show the limitations of contemporary approaches to tendencies in terms of prevention and interference, approaches that are inspired by J.S. Mill. And in the third section, a brief section, I try to show how Ravisson, as an Aristotelian, might help us to think about the nature of powers as such. The question of whether and how inclinations might stand between reasons and causes is one posed by the late Paul Hoffman in his 2012 posthumous essay, Reasons, Causes and Inclinations. Hoffman surveys medieval and early modern philosophy with the aim of discovering, I quote, an intelligible notion of inclining that is intermediate between providing a reason and being a mechanical cause, end quote. To this end, he turns to Aquinas and Leibniz in particular. The former speaks, of course, at length about inclinatio, and the latter of inclination without necessitation. Concerning Leibniz, however, it seems clear that the German philosopher, and Leibnizians tend to agree on this point, that the German philosopher is able to sloganize in this way when promoting a sense of human and divine freedom only because he understands necessitation as logical necessitation. Inclination, on Leibniz's account, does not exclude physical necessitation, but only logical necessitation. We would have to examine Leibniz's treatment of the notion of moral necessity, which he contrasts with physical necessity, to be sure there is nothing of philosophical interest in his sloganizing. And this is, in fact, something I do in a chapter of my book. My point here, however, is that in the work of Ravisson, which Hoffman does not mention, but which was certainly influenced by Leibniz's thinking, we find a more concerted attempt to present an intelligible notion of inclining that is intermediate between providing a reason and being a mechanical necessary cause, or being a mechanical cause according to the laws of physical necessity. Ravisson presents his ideas in his 1838 thesis De l'habitude, as I said, but the idea that an account of inclination can be gained from an analysis of habit may seem counterintuitive, perhaps even plainly wrong. If, as is often the case in modern philosophy, we think of acquired habits as thoughtless, mechanical and lifeless, if we think of motor habit in particular, as in Henri Bergson's memorable phrase, the fossilised residue of a spiritual activity, then nothing would seem to separate habit from mechanical causation and necessitation. In fact, in surveying early modern conceptions of inclination, Hoffman explicitly counsels that inclinations should not be conceived as habits. I quote, "We should not think of inclinations as the term is used by these philosophers to be dispositions or habits to act in a certain way. That is, they are not like being soluble or like being a smoker. Instead, we should think of them as incipient actions or movements that will attain a certain outcome unless something intervenes." Hoffman evidently understands the term disposition in a broad, non-tendential sense. the salt is disposed to dissolve in water, but it has no inclination to do so. He also treats disposition and habit as synonymous, or at least closely related terms. This usage is fairly traditional, given that Aristotle's notion of hexis, of a stable disposition, was translated into Latin as habitus, which in turn became the English habit. However, his example of a habit suggests that there is a clear difference between what he takes to be dispositions and what he takes to be habits. The smoker's tendency to smoke, we might think, is very different to the solubility of the salt, in that the smoker's tendency to smoke will precisely attain a certain outcome, namely smoking, unless something intervenes, namely the will. The same cannot be said, quite be said for the salt, since it requires the presence of water and cannot bring itself to its own realisation. The example is problematic, therefore, in that it seems to undermine Hoffman's own distinction between habits and inclinations, since both habits and inclinations are active tendencies that, as Hoffman puts it, in terms that he borrows from the early modern philosophers, will an active tendency that will realise itself as long as nothing comes to impede its realisation. Now, Ravisson discusses both active and passive habits. Active and passive habits. The former, such as motor habits, seem to involve the will in their acquisition, whereas the latter, passive habits, such as becoming used to a climate or a sound, do not. But he focuses more on the account of active habits. And his first argument is that in the acquisition of a motor habit, we gain, or at least we can gain, not only a facility in an action, such that the action requires less effort and voluntary attention, but also a tendency or inclination to carry it out. He's not invented this emphasis on tendency, for he's clearly influenced by the 18th century Scottish philosophers, and in particular by Reid's definition of habit in the chapter of Habit, same title as Ravisson's book, of his 1788 essay on the active powers of man. Here's Reid. Habit is commonly defined a facility of doing a thing acquired by having done it frequently. This definition is sufficient for habits of art, but the habits which may, with propriety, be called principles of action must give more than a facility. They must give an inclination or impulse to do the action, and that in many cases habits have this force cannot be doubted. A habit of art, i.e. a skill, such as being able to touch type, is a power or disposition, an ability that does not bring itself to its own manifestation and merely comes into operation at the command of the will. A tendency, inclination or proneness, proclivity to carry out an action, in contrast, is not just a power bringing facility and ease, and is more independent of the will. As Reid remarks insightfully, it often, I quote, requires a particular will and effort to forbear it. A tendency or inclination often requires a particular will and effort to forbear it. And it even, I quote again, makes us uneasy in the omission of it. So what's Reid saying? He's saying that skills make actions easy, tendencies unexercised can make the agent uneasy. Ravisson agrees with Reid then that an action in its repetition becomes more and more spontaneous, less and less immediately voluntary, and that this is because, in Ravisson's terms, a quote, an obscure and unreflective tendency, end quote, increasingly takes the place of volition and judgment. This increasing facility and developing tendency for Ravisson is a phenomenological datum that requires explanation, and it cannot be explained, he argues, by means of what we might call intellectualist or physiological theories. I'll leave his argument against intellectualist theories to one side, but concerning physiological theories, Ravisson argues that although physiology may someday be able to account for facility in an action, it will be unable to account for the tendency or inclination in it. I quote, "The increasing ease of the movements could perhaps be explained," it's your fourth quotation on the page, "the increasing ease of the movements could perhaps be explained hypothetically by some change which anatomy has not yet discovered in the physical constitution of the organs, but no organic modification can explain the tendency, the inclination whose progress coincides with the degradation of effort." One may wonder why Ravisson is so confident in his assertion, but to begin to illuminate its position, it's worth noting that it's close to Reid's sceptical response to physiological explanations of habit. Together with instinct, habit is one of the two mechanical principles of action for Reid, which, I quote, "require no attention, no deliberation, no will," end quote. and which are equally inexplicable in physical terms. The fifth quotation. I see no reason to think that we shall ever be able to assign the physical cause either of instinct or of the power of habit. Both seem to be parts of our original constitution. Their end and use is evident, but we can assign no cause of them but the will of him who made us. With regard to instinct, which is a natural propensity, this will perhaps be easily granted, but it is no less true with regard to that power and inclination which we acquire by habit. No man can show a reason why our doing a thing frequently should produce either facility or inclination to do it. Reid's claim is not just that it was not possible to adduce at the time a physical cause for why our doing something frequently produces a facility, propensity or inclination to do it, but that no one could ever reasonably hope to do so. Reid affirms not only that 18th century knowledge of the biological structure and mechanics of the human being was insufficient to account for the two principles, instinct and habit, but also that such knowledge, even as it advances, never will be able to account for them. There must, Reid claims, be, I quote, a cause of the power of habit. It may not be the most helpful formulation, but there must be a cause of the power of habit, end quote, to produce facility or inclination from repeated voluntary movements. But given the improbability of accounting for this cause physiologically, the impossibility, we may just as well invoke God, the will of him who made us, in order to explain it. Reid's assertion that neither facility nor inclination can be explained physiologically contrasts, at first glance, with Clavisson's more nuanced and apparently narrower claim, but this difference is more apparent than real. For Clavisson, a thinker who sees continuities everywhere, holds facility to be continuous with inclination, and so he cannot consistently hold, despite what he says, he cannot consistently hold that facility could be explained physiologically, whereas tendency cannot. What's important about Clavisson's thinking, however, is that he does radicalise Reid's position and address a fundamental inconsistency, even a paradox, within it. For the Scottish philosopher presents both instinct and habit as mechanical principles of action, whilst denying, oddly, that a physical and thus mechanical cause can ever be found for them. Habit and instinct as mechanical principles can't be explained mechanically. But if Reid really did believe that his notion of propensity or inclination in habit was a genuinely mechanical principle, it's hard to fathom why he would have such confidence that physical explanations would always fail. Reid admits that he uses the term mechanical. In fact, if you look closely, he ends up admitting that he uses the term mechanical, I quote, for distinction's sake, end quote. And he even says in one place that habit and instinct are a kind of mechanical principle. It's kind of backtracking slightly. Moreover, if he really did believe that habit was a mechanical principle, he would have to reject the common usage, according to which, I quote, we call many things actions of the man, which he neither previously conceived nor willed. He'd have to reject that common usage, and the common usage flies in the face of the, I quote, the strict philosophical sense, according to which nothing can be called the action of the man but what he previously conceived and willed or determined to do. End quote. That said, it remains to determine what habit as tendency or inclination is, if it's not a mechanical principle of action. And it remains to determine exactly why tendency cannot be explained according to a mechanistic physiology. Clavisson's principal argument on both points is this, it's the final quotation on the first page. Although movement, as it becomes a habit, leaves the sphere of will and reflection, it does not leave that of intelligence. It does not become the mechanical effect of an external impulse, but rather the effect of an inclination that follows from the will. This inclination is formed gradually, and consciousness, so far as it can trace it, always finds that it inclines towards the end that the will had originally proposed. But every inclination towards a goal implies intelligence. An acquired habit, an acquired habitual tendency, is continuous with the will and an original intention, and not opposed to the will and reflection. When I act habitually, I am, Clavisson argues, still the agent, even though the particular action is no longer occasioned deliberately with deliberation. Certainly, there are occasions when my tendencies or inclinations oppose my deliberate intentions. In front of the goal, the unsuccessful centre forward may have the tendency, with only the keeper to beat, to send the ball into row Z. Chavisson accepts, however, that tendencies can adopt the form of the apparently completely involuntary and perhaps even pathological phenomena that we know of as tics. And thus there's no need to deny that old tendencies or confused new ones can hinder my deliberate intentions. So Chavisson's argument is that what any kind of mechanistic physiology cannot account for is the degrees or the gradations of will in inclination. But also it can't explain the spontaneous nature of habitual tendencies. And that is to say the way an habitual tendency can bring itself to its own realization. Habitual actions are, on Chavisson's account, automatic. But we have to think about what the word automatic actually means. It doesn't really, I mean, according to a literal sense, mean mechanistic or mechanical. Because according to a mechanical framework, things can't move themselves. They can only be moved by other things. But habitual tendency is genuinely automatic in the sense it can bring itself into movement. Certainly, perhaps all habitual movements are responses to circumstances, situations, and stimuli. But these responses, as possessing the spontaneity of the will to a degree, are not what the behaviourist makes of them. An habitual disposition or inclination can, in this sense, bring itself to its realisation. And it may even always bring itself to its realisation if nothing else intervenes to prevent itself doing so. But the point is that on Chavisson's account, tendency is not a third-person phenomenon, and it's intrinsically related to the intelligence and the will. It's for these reasons that he offers the following characterization of the modal peculiarity of habit as tendency or inclination. It's a key passage of the text. Hence, habit is not an external necessity of constraints, but a necessity of attraction and desire. It is indeed a law of the limbs, which follows on from the freedom of spirit. But this law is a law of grace. It is the final cause that increasingly predominates over efficient causality and which absorbs the latter onto itself. And at that point, indeed, the end and the principle, the fact and the law are fused together within necessity. The basic point here is that Chavisson's argument is that habit is not a function of a mechanical necessity, a necessity of constraint, but referring back to Leibniz, a moral necessity, a necessity of attraction and desire. Obviously, that notion requires fleshing out and elaboration. But the difference between Chavisson and Leibniz in this connection, I would contend, is that the French philosopher is explicitly denies that inclination can be reduced to either the conscious pursuit of goals or to a mechanical force. Second section. There's clearly more to say here about Chavisson's notion of inclination. But the point of this paper is to try and use it to understand theories of tendency in the contemporary metaphysics of power. Much of the recent Anglophone work on tendencies draws from J.S. Mill's view that the laws of nature should be expressed as tendencies rather than necessities. In The Logic, Mill writes the following. It's a long quotation. If, for instance, it were stated a law of nature that a body to which a force is applied moves in the direction of the force with a velocity proportioned to the force directly and to its own mass inversely, when in point of fact some bodies to which force is applied do not move at all, and those which do move, at least in the region of the Earth, are, from the very first, retarded by the action of gravity and other resisting forces, and at the last, stopped altogether, it's clear that the general proposition, though it would be true under a certain hypothesis, would not express the facts as they occur. To accommodate the expression of the law to the real phenomena, we must say not that the object moves, but that it tends to move in the direction and with the velocity specified. We might indeed guard our expression in a different mode by saying that the body moves in that manner unless prevented, or except insofar as prevented by some counteracting cause. But the body does not only move in that manner unless counteracted, it tends to move in that manner even when counteracted. It still exerts, in the original direction, the same energy of movement as if the first impulse had been undisturbed. These facts are correctly indicated by the expression tendency. All laws of causation, in consequence of their liability to be counteracted, require to be stated in words affirmative of tendencies only and not of actual results. The balloon, for example, the balloon's not falling stands in it as an exception to the law according to which bodies fall to the ground, but laws on Mill's view of science can tolerate no exceptions. For this reason, he rejects any conception of laws as conditional necessities, true only under a certain hypothesis and subject to a ceteris paribus qualification. A body falls, all other things being equal, and that is to say, if no other forces act on it that prevents or interfere with its fall. Scientific laws for Mill would thus, in this way, have no real hold in the empirical world, where very often things are not equal. Hence, the law should be expressed in terms of things tending to fall. Mill, to be sure, does not merely say that laws express statistical regularities, what usually happens rather than what always happens. His more metaphysical idea is that laws express a force or capacity that produces the statistical regularity, a force that is itself a tendency. As Nancy Cartwright puts it, Mill, I quote, is ready to distinguish laws about tendencies from the more common idea of tendency laws, i.e. laws that say what tends to happen or happens for the most part, end quote. In this way, Mill posits the existence of occult qualities that are anathema to the consistent empiricist. Yet, what of this tendency is an occult force producing a statistical regularity? What can Mill and what can we say about it? The first point to note following T.S. Champlin, I'm not quite sure which, in his instructive 1991 article, Tendencies, is that Mill, in our passage and elsewhere, fails to observe the difference between two different tendency expressions. There is a difference between a tendency towards or away from something and a tendency to do or be something. The latter is distinguished grammatically from the former by its infinitival construction, but there is also a distinction in sense. As Champlin puts it, it is, as I quote, bigger difference. It's as big a difference as a difference between the inclination of an inclined plane and the plane's having an inclination. That is, it's being inclined to do or be something, end quote. Tending towards something means going in its direction, or at least somehow aiming in its direction. Tending to do or be something, in contrast, suggests a periodic, gappy performance of something. And tending to do or be something can name both the empirical regularity and the force that produces that regularity. Tending towards something and tending to do something are thus different. As Champlin argues, they are, I quote, separate in meaning and not logically connected, end quote. Mill, however, takes the first sense of tendency to serve as an explanation of the second. He ties himself up in knots when doing so. When he writes that a body in that passage tends to move in that manner even when counteracted, it still exerts in the original direction the same energy of movement as if the first impulse had been undisturbed, end quote. He clearly does not mean to say that sometimes the body moves in the original direction even when counteracted. He means instead that the body, though it is no longer going in the original direction, is still attempting or trying to go in the original direction, i.e. still exerting the same force. He expresses the same point with less confusion elsewhere when criticising someone, I quote, for making the wrong kind of assertion. He predicted an actual result when he should have predicted a tendency to that result. A power acting with a certain tendency in that direction, end quote. Here, tendency is clearly described as tending in a certain direction, tending towards something. So, Mill wants to incorporate the gappy empirical realization of causal regularity into the formulation of laws itself, since he cannot tolerate laws having exceptions due to interference and prevention. And in order to do so, he claims, first, that laws describe empirical tendencies, and second, that these empirical tendencies can be explained by forces tending in a certain direction towards a goal. Now, the real problem here is not, as Champlin suggests, that Miller's return to a notion of tendency as an occult quality, a notion to which Mill really has no right and which we should avoid. At least if we are more sympathetic to Power's ontology, the real problem, as Champlin himself leads us to see, is rather that it's not obvious how the one sense of tendency, tending towards something, can possibly explain the other, tending to do or be something. We need a force to explain the gappy empirical performance of something, and thus we need to understand tending to do or be something in a metaphysical sense. But it's not obvious how a notion of tending towards, however exactly we may spell it out, can give us this. Mill needs to explain how his forces as tendencies allow for their prevention and counteraction by other forces. He needs to explain what is specially tendential about forces such that they do not necessitate their typical outcomes, but only tend to produce them. But in the end, the bare idea of forces tending in a certain direction does not do this. Tending towards does not explain tending to result in something. The possibility of prevention and interference, in other words, is not explained by the claim that forces point in a certain direction. Mill's approach, as I said, has greatly influenced contemporary tendency theories of causation. In 2003, Daniel von Wachter, citing Mill, neither resolves nor even addresses the fundamental problem. According to von Wachter, empirical regularities need to be explained, and they can be, I quote, best explained by assuming the existence of tendencies, end quote. With tendency understood as, I quote, a bias of the world towards carrying on in a certain way, end quote. At a certain point in time, T1, there is a tendency to S at T2 if, I quote, S is a state of affairs that came about if things developed according to the tendency, end quote. Tendency on this account then, as with Mill, is a tending towards that can be counteracted by other tendencies. Newtonian forces properly considered are, for von Wachter, tendencies, not necessities. And it's because tendencies can be counteracted that, I quote, we should stop saying that causes are sufficient for or necessitate their effects, end quote. The cause, i.e. the tendency or force, may be present and in operation, but its typical effects may not in this instance be realised due to the intervention of other forces. Like Mill, however, von Wachter says nothing about what is tendential in his supposed tendencies, such that they do not necessarily produce their effects. In Getting Causes from Powers, Mumford and Anjem attempt to develop von Wachter's million position by stressing the modal peculiarity and novelty of such a tendency theory. According to the, I quote, bold thesis that the possibility of prevention of the result of a causal process leaves no room for any kind of necessity in causal production, end quote. They argue that causation involves, I quote again, an irreducible sui generis modality, something between pure necessity and pure contingency, and that is reducible to neither, end quote. This sui generis modality they name the dispositional modality, but they struggle to give any positive content to what it is exactly they have thus baptised. Every time they say what their dispositional modality is, they say only what it's not. For them, a tendency is a power that doesn't necessitate its typical effect. But they do not state clearly, and this point, sort of, our discussions help me to see this, they don't state clearly whether a power on its own, in abstraction from its relation to possible extrinsic preventers, is intrinsically tendential. And they provide no positive account of what this intrinsic tendency or tendentiality could be. After Mill and von Wachter, they conceive of tendency as a tending towards, but the idea of a disposition tending towards its manifestation, its being inclined towards that manifestation, is conceived merely negatively in relation to necessity. A tendency is a power that does not necessitate its effect, and it does not because another outcome is always possible, given that the tendency can be counteracted. Moreover, when Mumford and Anjem attempt to show that the possibility of a power's manifestation is more than one possibility amongst the potentially infinite number of equals, more than a mere abstract logical or metaphysical possibility, they do so only in terms of statistical regularities and probability. Dispositions are, I quote, reliable, tend to manifest and dispose to happen with a non-negligible probability, end quote. With their dispositional modality, then, Mumford and Anjem are, in effect, offering a propensity theory of probability without saying anything positive about what propensities are. To be fair to them both, Mumford and Anjem are quite aware of the problem of how to characterise positively their dispositional modality. And perhaps the most interesting and illuminating aspect of their project is their appeal to agency as offering direct experience of it. Agency, they argue, offers us insights that causal relations in the world beyond us do not. I quote, our actions only dispose or tend towards their outcomes, never guaranteeing them. And everyone knows what this means, end quote. And everyone knows what this means because we have, supposedly, a direct experience of tendency in agency. In their appeal to the obvious, however, Mumford and Angem, strangely, do not point to what we might ordinarily and intuitively call tendencies in our actions. A tendency, for example, to be flustered, to lose one's temper, or to leave the house without first checking to see if the back door is locked. They focus on purely voluntary actions, according to the claim that voluntary action is always tendential in that my intended outcome can be prevented by other forces. Now, however undeniable it may be that we all in some sense know that our intentions can be frustrated, it's hard to see how this common knowledge amounts to a direct experience of a disposing or tending. Once again, Mumford and Angem say nothing positive about this direct experience and write merely of knowledge of the typical external result of volition being prevented. And they don't write of the internal process of volition or trying itself. They try to find something positive in failure, but they fail to do so. For this reason, they offer no grounds to resist the Humean argument that I experience no causal force at all in agency, and that my sense of having some kind of causal force is merely the illusory result of past experience and association. I've criticised this attempt to discover an experience of tendency and voluntary agency at length elsewhere, particularly in the light of Pierre Mendebian's very different anti-Humean claim that there is a force of necessity, which is not a necessary connection, to be found in agential causation. Yet I do think Mumford and Angem's attempt is illuminating, though not for reasons that they would themselves endorse. Their peculiar attempt to discover an experience of tendency without regard to real experiences of tendencies gives the lie, I think, to notions of tendency based on prevention and interference. That a force can be prevented from producing its typical effect is not, I contend, sufficient to name it in any meaningful sense a tendency. And it is because thinking about tendency in terms of prevention does not give us any strong or recognisable sense of tendency that Mumford and Angem can ignore our actual experience of tendencies when they pretend to look for it. Mumford and Angem's failure also helps us to see clearly that appealing to a notion of tending towards is not going to make any more intelligible the possibility of prevention and interference. It doesn't help. The invoking an idea of a force tending towards its outcome doesn't help us to understand the possibility of prevention and interference. The contemporary metaphysics of powers might have been saved much fruitless toil if Mill had been prepared to accept that laws apply ceteris paribus and that causation involves a conditional rather than absolute necessity, a necessity dependent on background conditions. In that way, Mill would not have encouraged us to think tending towards could explain tending to. Finally, in this section, that Mumford and Angem's notion of the dispositional modality is distinguishable only in name from a notion of conditional necessity also becomes apparent in their chapter on the forebears of the dispositional modality in their forthcoming What Tends to Be, which Stephen was good enough to let me read. Mumford and Angem read Aristotle and Aquinas, but also Mill, Geach, Bhaskara, among others, on the idea of tendency. And they often complain about the inconsistency of their predecessors, who speak of tendency but usually categorise it modally according to some kind of idea of conditional necessity. The sense of tendency of which Geach, for one, writes is the million sense of tendential force as tendency towards. And given that nothing positive can be said about it, which would help us understand in any specially illuminating way how a force can be prevented from producing its typical effect, it's not surprising that Geach, and even Mill himself, retreat to a conditional necessity view of causation. In the end, Mumford and Angem's dispute with the Millian tradition is merely a dispute about words. What they call the dispositional modality is exactly what their forebears discuss as a conditional necessity. The dispute is about words and not a dispute about tendencies, insofar as all parties agree with Mill that tendencies are tendencies towards. Final brief section then. My argument then is that if we conceive tendency only in terms of a force that can be prevented from realising itself, then we should not bother with an idea of tendency at all. A notion of conditional necessity will do just fine and lends itself to less confusion. I do think, however, that we should concern ourselves with tendencies, but with tendencies in a stronger sense, and as they are actually given in experience. I do think we should concern ourselves with tendencies, but tendencies in their distinction from, but continuity with, voluntary action. Champlin holds one of the main puzzles. He considers one of the main puzzles concerning tendencies to be how much teleology there is in them. To what degree are tendencies teleological is his question. For Ravissant, they are precisely teleological to a degree, depending on how ingrained the habit is, how much it has become second nature. Ravissant's account of habit as tendency or inclination, going back to Mumford and Angerm, helps to realise, by radicalising them, some of Mumford and Angerm's intentions, strangely, in getting causes from powers. For Mumford and Angerm argue that the dispositional modality is a kind of spectrum between the poles of pure possibility and pure necessity. They also argue that all powers are tendencies, and they also argue that we can argue by analogy that tendencies like the ones we experience in ourselves exist in the world beyond us. With a stronger notion of tendency, Ravissant defends the same three claims. Habit, he argues, in becoming less and less voluntary, shows us that there is a continuous graduated scale constituted by, I quote, a spontaneity that is at once active and passive, equally opposed to mechanical fatality and to reflexive freedom, end quote. He also argues, given that all powers occupy a position on this scale, that all powers are to some measure tendential in the sense of tendency that he's outlined. And finally, he claims that by, I quote, by the most powerful of analogies, end quote, we can argue that the tendency and the continuity that we find in our own powers is present throughout nature as a whole, the nature beyond us, whose powers we can't empirically observe. There's more to say about all of these issues, of course, but let me close with some remarks on the question of what a tendency actually is. We have to determine how a tendency or inclination, to ask the question of what a tendency is, it still remains for us to determine how a tendency or inclination can belong to something. What sort of quality is a power or tendency? How can it reside in a thing? I conclude with Ravissant's Aristotelian suggestions on this point. I think we've got both passages. Yeah, final two passages. In Reflection and Will, the end of movement is an idea, an ideal to be accomplished. It is a possibility to be realised. But as the end becomes fused with the movement and the movement with the tendency, possibility, the ideal, is really realised in it. The idea becomes being, the very being of the movement and of the tendency determined by the idea. Habit becomes more and more a substantial idea. Inclinations become more and more the form, the way of being, even the very being of those organs. The spontaneity of desire is dispersed in some way within the indeterminate multiplicity of the organism. Ravissant's claim then, and obviously it's metaphysically it's an interesting and perhaps expensive claim, it's going to involve lots of commitments, but his claim is that inclinations become the very being of the body. A body that's clearly not the object as examined in the third person by a doctor. Recalling Kant's lesson that being is not a real predicate, it seems that Ravissant is proposing that inclinations and thus powers as such are not real predicates of beings. In other words, they're not beings or even ordinary characteristics of things. How that thought might impact on contemporary debates concerning the status of powers or dispositions, however, is an issue that I leave for the discussion or for a book.